reach and inspire the leaders of tomorrow, and innovate, collaborate, and accelerate positive change year after year after year. Drawing on the rich resources and heritage of Yale University and fueled by its faculty, students, and alumni, the thinkers, the doers, the creators, the discoverers, the boundary breakers, the difference makers, those committed to leading and serving, those who never stop exploring. This is Yale Explores. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Class of 96 and President of the Yale Club of Washington, D.C., Anant Raut.
Good evening, everybody. I said good evening, everybody. That's more like it. It's wonderful to see so many friends, parents, and fellow alums out here tonight. When I first became a director of the Yale Club of D.C., the first question I asked was, how do you make a regional alumni association relevant in the age of Facebook and LinkedIn? And the answer is through events like this, events that bring together the D.C., Yale alumni community, and the university. I've had the privilege of serving as the president of the Yale Club of Washington, D.C. since June. And on behalf of my fellow board members, many of whom are in the audience here tonight, and whom you will know by their ribbon badges, I'm delighted to welcome you to the inaugural Yale Explores event. We've brought some printed materials about the club that I hope you will take with you on your way out, or visit our website, yaleclubdc.org, to find out more about some of the exciting events that we have in the coming months. And I hope you enjoyed the reception as much as I did, connecting with old friends and making some new ones. And please stay after the program for more food, more drink, more discussion. And take a moment to record your story in the Yale Explores video booth. The work of tonight's presenters, which spans the fields of journalism, architecture, urbanization, economics, and social psychology, exemplifies the groundbreaking research and the interdisciplinary collaborations that are a hallmark of Yale. Mushfiq Mubarak is a professor of economics at Yale. He conducts field experiments exploring ways to induce people in developing countries to adopt technologies or behavior that are likely to improve welfare. Elihu Rubin, Yale College class of 1999, is associate professor of urbanism at the Yale School of Architecture. And he almost didn't make it tonight because one of the perils of the 21st century city, his train got delayed by 90 minutes, but he's here tonight and we're happy to have him. Because his work bridges the urban disciplines, focusing on the built environment, city planning, urban geography and the cultural landscape, transportation and mobility, architectural preservation, and the social life of urban space. Karen Sito is the Frederick C. Hickson Professor of Geography and Urbanization Science at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. She's a leader in the area of urbanization and global change, and her work has generated new insights on the interaction between urbanization and food systems, the effects of urban expansion on biodiversity and cropland loss, urban energy use and emissions, and urban mitigation of climate change. Tonight's moderator, Margaret Warner, is special global affairs correspondent for PBS NewsHour. She reports on and analyzes U.S. foreign policy and developments abroad. She joined the NewsHour in 1993 after 2 decades as a political White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine and the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Warner is a member of the Yale College class of 1971 and a former trustee of the Yale Corporation. We're also fortunate to have with us President Peter Salovey. He'll close the discussion with insights on tonight's topic from the perspective of a social psychologist, and will highlight Yale's unique ability to play a vital role in addressing such pressing challenges facing our world. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming our panel to the stage for Yale Explores.
Thank you, Anand. Thank you all for being here. When they said that we would have Yale chairs, I pictured deep plush, dark blue, you know. But no, this is very, very authentic. It's wonderful to have you all here, and it really is a pleasure for me to be asked to host or moderate this very first in the Yale Explore series. Each one, the next one's going to be in Boston, takes a pressing issue of the time, really of the 21st century, and tries to explore it from the different disciplines with some of our dazzling Yale faculty members, three of whom have joined us here tonight. It really, this series was developed in response to Yale alums who said they wanted to find a way to be more engaged with Yale, particularly the intellectual energy of Yale, without having to go to New Haven. As Elihu can attest, a long trip. So all of my three panelists are doing groundbreaking work in their respective fields that will be called upon to help answer this question or this large issue about the 21st century city and society. Specifically, how do we create sustainable and vibrant communities, urban communities for urban dwellers of the future? Now, that sounds like an old question, I know, but it's particularly urgent today because the population of the planet, which is right now, as of last month, 6.7 billion, according to the UN, is going to grow by another 25% in just the next 30 years. Now, that means 9.7 billion in the year 2050. This is something that's, and a great majority of them, as you'll hear tonight, are going to live in cities. They're going to be concentrated in cities through both migration and birth rates. Now, the impact of this, I found hard to grasp without seeing it visually. So we've got two maps to help you do that. They were designed, by the way, by a PhD student at Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, actually a student of Professor Sito's, Kang Ning Huang. And this is what the globe looks like now, or to be specific, last year, as it would if it were nighttime, 1:30 a.m. at the same time all over the world. And these are really taken from NASA slides. You can see them on the internet every day. And, you know, you look at this and you say, looks like there's plenty of open space. What's the problem? Now, here is the same view of the Earth as it's forecast to appear at 1:30 a.m. everywhere on the planet 30 years from now. Now, the first time I saw these even, the contrast didn't hit me. So let's do it again. Let's focus again. Here again is the planet at 1:30 a.m. today. And now, building on the research of Mr. Kang Ning Huang, who had to do a lot of complicated computer and just brain computations, this is what it will look like in 2050. Now, as you see, most of the additional 2+ billion people are not living in Siberia or the Sahara, or the Amazonian forest, or the Australian interior. In fact, a third of the new 2 billion will live just three places. You can see it right here. The Indian subcontinent, China, and Nigeria. If you just look at that bright cluster of lights, say, along the northern edge of the Indian subcontinent, it gives you an idea, too, of the greater affluence that is expected by then, which is another whole issue, but we'll get to that later. So this urban explosion is, I think, also occurring, if you look at the map, in some of the world's poorest and, right now, most politically unstable areas. But that only makes sense because if you look at urbanization as a phenomenon, 80% of the whole Western Hemisphere, North and South and Europe, is considered 80% urbanized. So you can see where the cities have a lot of room to grow, namely Asia and Africa, where they're roughly 40% urbanized. So the first big picture idea we all thought would be good to explore is how should we look at this urbanization issue? In other words, the explosion's underway. Is this a problem to be managed? Is it a calamity to be mitigated, or is it an opportunity? And I'm going to start with Professor Sito, who does a lot of study of every aspect of urbanization.
No, thanks, Margaret. Whether it's a problem or whether it's an opportunity, I think a lot depends on how cities will develop in the next 20 to 30 years. So the work that my student has done and others in my lab, we've shown that every day for the next 30 years, an area about the size of 20,000 American football fields will become urban. Will become urban, oh. Right? So these are croplands, these are forests, these are pastures. And so how we manage that growth will have a huge impact on the environment and what these cities will become.
And so help us just, how should we look at it in context? In other words, there was very rapid urbanization from 1900 to 2000, I think 300%, yet the planet seemed to adjust. How does this compare?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a hard one. Well, if we look at what happened during the last century, urbanization was happening at much lower levels of economic development and much lower levels of consumption. And much of the urban consumption was happening around how cities were developed. And in fact, the availability of resources around towns and villages and cities really limited the growth of the size of cities. But today, we can ship our materials for our cities from all around the world. So we actually have literally the planet's resources to draw upon to grow cities.
Professor Mubarak, through the last 150, really 200 plus years, predictions of population growth always came along with predictions of doom and gloom. And I know I don't need to explain to this Yale-educated audience who Thomas Malthus was, but he was the economist and demographer who wrote back in 1798 that the size of the expanding human population, since humans like to procreate, was going to grow at geometric rates, and that agricultural production and the means and methods of agricultural production could not possibly keep up. It could only kind of grow arithmetically, is the way he put it. And so this would lead to disease, death, premature death, social upheaval. So what happened to the Malthusian theory?
So I think what that theory misses is the amazing rate of technological progress and innovation that we've seen. And in fact, cities have a lot to do with that. So I'll share an anecdote to explain what happened. So when I was growing up in Bangladesh, so this is in the 80s, I've just dated myself, we were worried a lot about food security, right? So on TV programs like this, people would, you know, experts would come on and say, you know, we have 100 million people that we're struggling to feed, and the population is projected to increase to 150 million. How on earth would we ever feed all these people in this tiny landmass the size of Wisconsin, hosting half the U.S. population? And right now, it's not a point of discussion anymore. That's not a problem at all. To be sure, Bangladesh has many, many other problems, but food security is not one of them, right? And what happened in between was the Green Revolution. There was new varieties of seeds where crop productivity is now three times as mm-hmm. high as it used to be, right?
And these are hybridized seeds.
Exactly, and more drought resistant or flood resistant, so that it allows you to, the reason productivity went up so much is that it allows you to plant two or three crop cycles, right? And where do innovations come from? They most often come from cities. And this is because cities are where smart people come together, they mix ideas, and that creates new ideas and new innovations.
That's really true? Yeah. I mean, I think of Thoreau. I don't know. So you're saying cities themselves are a place that has a special energy.
That's right. And so it's very, very clear in the economic data. So, for example, if you look across the world, these are studies by macroeconomists. So productivity in cities all around the world is about 3.5 times as the productivity in rural areas within the same country. So 350% more is what people earn. Right? And that's actually, when you're going back to the original question, are cities a problem to manage mm-hmm. or are they an opportunity? Right. So an economist, when we see that number, it points to a huge opportunity, which is, if you can get people to move from rural areas to the mm-hmm. urban areas, we're going to see this huge gain in productivity, right? And one reason why we think that developing countries may be remaining poor is that people seem to be inefficiently spatially allocated too much away from cities.
So, Professor Rubin, you are an expert in cities. Think of the most vibrant cities we can, you know, New York, Istanbul, with tremendous amount of both intellectual and economic financial energy. Still, there are huge pockets of poverty, disease, and also social alienation. Do you think that is always going to come with urban life? Is that something that just has to be factored in to what's ahead, or is there some way around that?
Right. Well, thank you, Margaret, and thanks to all of you for joining us. Yeah, I think what you're describing really is or has been part and parcel to the urban condition of uneven development, and that even within cities where there's tremendous amount of innovation and development and growth and wealth generation, part and parcel to that is the other side of the coin. We hope that over time cities will become more equitable in how the wealth of those cities is distributed. But it's not something, but it has been something that has been part of urbanization. You know, I study primarily American cities, and in American cities we see two trends that I think many of you may relate to intuitively. We have very exciting, bustling cities that are growing, like New York and San Francisco, Washington, D.C. as well. Even New Haven is beginning to grow a little bit now. And the challenges of places like that become questions like affordable housing and equal access to transportation and gentrification or the negative side of gentrification, the kind of displacement that comes with that. On the other side, we have cities like Detroit and parts of St. Louis and other American cities that aren't growing, that are diminishing. And so there's unevenness, I think, especially in the United States, not only within cities themselves, but across different cities. And planners today, in some places, are beginning to plan for the diminishment of cities, where planning had always been geared towards growth. So there's very different challenges in different American cities as that unevenness is observed.
So Professor Shido, jump in, and you all travel overseas a lot. What do city officials in these developing parts of the world and of course, national officials tell you? What do they expect? Do they think they can plan it? Do they think this is a good thing? Do they have a plan, or is it just growing willy-nilly?
Okay. the reaction I get most often, and I should give a little bit of background. So Anand kindly introduced me as someone who tries to induce people to do things that we think are good for them. So one of the things I try to induce people to do is to migrate to cities. That's part of my research. I buy them round trip bus fares and see if they go, and when they go, do their families do better? Right?
And these are, but I've heard you describe this, it's a temporary thing. So they go in and work, and then they can come back. And,
exactly. Yeah. It's a temporary internal migration within countries from rural to urban areas. And so, and because of that, I have to engage with policymakers in various cities a lot now, in Bangladesh, in Indonesia, in India, China. And the most common theme that you hear, these are policymakers who, by and large, live in cities, is that they think of migration as an invasion to repel, right? Because, you know, what you see is, oh, these migrants are coming in, and they're adding to the slum population, they're dirtying up the city, and that's a problem we need to manage, right? It's absolutely true that it is a problem that we need to manage. We need to provide proper access to sanitation, to water, right? Other public services that migrant populations need, right? But the answer is not to stop urbanization. It's the reason why those numbers and those lights that you showed are the way they are is because cities are the places of the future. These are more productive places, and we're going to be moving there. The United States and Canada used to be very rural areas, about rural countries, about 150, 200 years ago. Those countries have urbanized, and look where we are. And we shouldn't be preventing India or China or Bangladesh from following the same path.
I was struck by just, if you looked at the 20th century, even though the population, what did I say, 300% up, that the rate of extreme poverty went from something like, in 1910, it was something like 80% of the people on the planet would be considered extreme poverty, which is under $2 a day in today's terms. And then by 2000, it was 14 or 15 or 16%. Now, of course, there are many places with abject poverty, but I guess maybe that goes to prove your point. All right, what about the flip side of that, though, Professor Sito? There's a historian named Charles Mann, who some of you may have read. He wrote a book called 1491 about what this continent looked like before Columbus, and then 1493. And he has a long piece in The Atlantic last month, and the gist of it is, how will we feed the new global middle class? And he posits this theory that affluence is not our greatest achievement, but our biggest problem. And his point is, if all these new residents of our planet aspire to live as we do, consuming the kind of resources we are, eating up the food chain to animal products, that we're going to reach the breaking point. What do you think of that? Is affluence part of the pressure that's coming, that's like a multiplier?
Completely. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to tease out what is the income effect, the affluence effect, versus what's the urban effect. And for folks who've been studying urbanization and its impact on food systems for a long time, and those were primarily economists, they were basically saying, well, as people get richer, their diets change. They switch to a more meat-based, dairy, and processed foods. Mm-hmm. But we're also realizing that there's a, beyond the affluence effect, there's also an urban effect. The fact that you're in a place with lots of other people with different ideas, maybe different cultures, you're exposed to different things. But we're also learning that urban planning has a really big impact on what we buy and how we eat. So you think about how frequently you get in your car to buy your food. Do you shop daily or weekly or monthly? Do you have food delivered to you? And that actually has a really big impact on the resources at the planetary scale as well. I mean, in the U.S., about 40% of all food that's grown is wasted, like thrown away.
Professor Rubin, you want to jump in on this?
Well, yeah.
About affluence and the effect, in addition to the inequality that we talked about.
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, one of the big issues in American cities is our food deserts, places where it's very difficult to get healthy food, and where the bodega or the corner store becomes one of the main sources for food and for food shopping. That's something that myself and my colleagues are very concerned about, is how, especially at a time when affluence in the United States has increasingly brought revolutions in healthy food for some people, how do we make farmers markets not something that is a kind of elite choice or privilege, but something that is available to everyone? And I think it also connects, especially in American cities, to schools. And how food is distributed in schools, and trying to put into place policies that will encourage, if not force, schools to start thinking about forming some of these partnerships with local growers, with making healthy food. The food system, the system of waste that Karen's describing, is driven right through so many of the schools in the United States, and it is considered by many to be a major crisis that really must be addressed.
So does this go on in other parts of the world, food waste?
Yes, and we're seeing it growing in places where there's growing urbanization. So part of the food waste is also related to food away from home. Mm-hmm. So as we have more jobs away from home or outside of the home, so dual income families, we see more households eating more of their foods away from home. Mm-hmm. And that also leads to more food waste. But I think going back to Mushfik's point about innovation, we see a lot of innovation in food development in cities as well. So whether it's preservation of food cultures or innovative ways to not waste food, like minimize food waste.
Now, what about the dangers, too? And I think this was part of Charles Malthus's sort of theory, is that this density, increased density, and as you said, sometimes it's of different kinds of people, can lead really to social upheaval, social explosions. Do you see that growing?
Yeah. So far I've been the optimist about cities, mm-hmm. but I should also be a realist and say that, look, these are important challenges to manage. It's not that we just allow people to urbanize without restraint and that it'll all work out through innovation. It doesn't always all work out. So there is going to be conflict. So for example, if migrants are coming in, what are they coming in for? They're coming in for access to jobs, right? And in cities, especially without public transport, where it's harder to get around, those migrants need to live where the jobs are, right? And if they're going to live where the jobs are, they're going to be located right next to the people who think of those slums as unattractive, mm-hmm. dirty places that's lowering their quality of life and house values. And so that's going to be an important challenge to manage. Now, some countries have responded. We've had programs like this both in the U.S. and in India, something like a moving to opportunity type program where you respond by building nice housing somewhere where land is a little bit cheaper. And surprisingly, this is a study from Ahmedabad in Western India, that the government provided very, very nice housing to slum residents, right? And then we're trying to evaluate exactly what happened, one of my former students. And then it turns out it's hard to evaluate because a year later, 2 years later, you go back to that nice housing project and nobody's there. They've moved right back to the slum.
Really?
And the reason is access to jobs is so much more important than the quality of housing.
Mm-hmm. Margaret, could I say something about that too, this connection between dense cities and social upheavals, perhaps? I mean, what you're identifying is a very important link, especially in the history of urban planning in Western Europe and in the United States, the idea that dense industrial cities would foster all of these radical ideas like socialism or something like that, and people coming up in revolt against capital or against the living conditions or against the landlords. I'd say that in some sense, the connection between cities and social upheaval or social movements is one of the great strengths of cities. It's in cities that so many of the great social movements of the 20th century have taken shape. It's one of the innovative aspects of urbanism, in fact. And quite a lot of urban planning to do with attempting to improve housing conditions or to decenter the city in different ways has been an effort to try to quell some of the more radical tendencies of social upheaval.
Can you give us an example?
Well, one example, for example, one of the visions of urban decentralization as a kind of vision comes in late 19th century England, where Ebenezer Howard invents the idea of the garden city, which is to say, why should we let our industrial cities grow and grow and grow without mm-hmm. stop? Let's let them grow to a certain amount and then hive off a satellite city and connect them all by railroads with open green spaces in between. And it was never built exactly as Howard intended, although Letchworth Garden City and Welwyn Garden City are some examples. But that became a very powerful idea of how to decenter the city. Now, some began to argue that it was taken too far, especially in the post-war period where the cities begin to sprawl out without many of the guiding features that made Howard's ideas so persuasive. But even the beginnings of tenement laws in New York, for example, and the progressive ideas behind public housing, for example, in the interwar period, are very much linked to the critique of the density of the central city and wanting to provide healthful housing for the working people of the city. And this becomes a very complicated story, especially in the post-war period, where we've taken much more ambivalent attitudes to some of these projects, especially when they're very high and far off the ground. And I'm sure many in this audience have seen films like Citizen Jane about Jane Jacobs that have really dramatized some of that tension around planners' views mm-hmm. of the best for people and really observing what it's like for people on the ground. But this preoccupation with the potential social fallout of density has been and really continues to be a major preoccupation. And it is a bit ironic, perhaps, because it's precisely the density that makes cities efficient in so many ways and makes them innovative in so many ways.
Yeah, I would say from the environmental side, there's mm-hmm. no other metric that's more controversial as well, because mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's that metric that often gets misused and misapplied, right? So, when we think about density, it's a ratio. And it's what do you put on the numerator, what do you put in the denominator?
Right.
And often people think, well, it's density that leads to, let's say, innovation or the economies of scale. But actually, we're learning that it's not density alone, but it's the co-location of certain activities, right? It's the co-location of people with jobs. So it's exactly what Mushfiq was saying. It's the co-location of people and jobs that allows them to take alternative forms of transportation rather than, you know, cars. So, but at the same time, it is that one metric that many, many people, from planners to geographers to economists, use, but use so differently.
And we just did on these maps, to some degree.
As I'm hearing the three of us, one way to summarize, I think, what we're saying is, so when people come together in cities with high density, they're interacting with each other. Those interactions sometimes produce wonderful things. They're positive interactions. They produce ideas. They produce innovations. And those interactions also produce a lot of negative externalities, such as sanitation problems, crime, social upheaval, political. And I think...
And sometimes intolerance. I mean, sometimes ethnic or religious strife.
And I think the way forward is for us to figure out how to accentuate those positive interactions and mitigate or manage those negative interactions.
So I want to ask each of you, because we're supposed to be talking about a healthy city, what's your definition of a healthy city? Do you want to go first? And then what are the biggest barriers to it? Who wants to go first? I'm going to throw it out.
As an economist, I have an easy answer to this, which is healthy cities are the places that make people productive.
And what's the biggest barrier? Or maybe we'll go around and then we'll come back to the barrier.
Well, I'm thinking about the planetary scale. So a lot of cities right now, it's very chic to have these sustainable city plans, and that's great, but often it's about what happens within the city. And ultimately, I'm thinking we have to preserve planetary health. So in my mind, a healthy city is one that preserves the well-being of the planet. That includes people that live in other places that provide the services or resources within a city.
Yeah, and I think I'll give a more on-the-ground kind of answer about this. I mean, healthy cities, in my view, are places where it is safe and desirable to walk, and to have access to transit and access to healthy food. I mean, the healthiest cities are cities where the people living in the city are the healthiest, where they experience the least amount of stress in their daily lives, where they...
That's not true.
Stress is good. We want to encourage more, you mean?
Who would say people in cities have less stress? Maybe.
No, they have more.
More,
And what we and they have more stress for all kinds of reasons, including the difficulties of accessing basic services. I mean, actually, the issue of mobility is a very key one, I think, to key to healthfulness at the scale of the city. I mean, many people know, there is an obesity epidemic in the United States. It's not tied directly to car culture or television culture, but there are links there. And cities where people can walk and can walk to services will actually make a big difference.
Interestingly, the cities where people walk and are co-located with their jobs are cities that also have the lowest emissions per capita energy use as well. So there is this feedback to the planetary scale.
Example?
Such as Taipei, Taiwan, Tokyo in Japan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Copenhagen.
Places with public transit.
With public transit, but where people are co-located with work. That's a really critical thing.
So back to you, Professor Mubarak, what is the greatest barrier you see?
So I think in terms of barriers, my answer is going to be very similar to the types of things that both Karen and Ellie were talking about, which is that cities lead to pollution. That's going to be a barrier to increasing productivity. People aren't as healthy, and they're not going to be as productive. Cities with high density also induce crime. So if people are not, or they have to live in areas where they're not fully confident in the property rights. You know, if you're in a slum and you don't have proper paperwork over your housing, then you're not going to be willing or able to invest in it. So I think we need to design or develop, I'm talking from a developing country perspective now, we need to design new institutions for these urbanizing economies.
Professor Sito? biggest barrier to be overcome to make cities more, you know, ecologically,
sound.
In tune with the planet?
Yeah, I would say induced demand. That people, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Do you want to live in this type of housing, in this type of development, because that's how you grew up and that's what you know? And we see that there is a path dependency, there's this inertia where if you grew up in a particular type of community, single family detached home, let's say, you're more likely to want that. Whereas if you lived in a, let's say, walkable community in New York City or Washington, D.C., you're more likely to want that as you get older, right? And so I think that's one of the big challenges is how do we create different types of demands, create different types of pathways for people to live in?
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. I think one of the biggest barriers, and I guess I'm thinking mostly about American cities now, and I hate to say it, is politics.
I'm glad someone brought up political dysfunction.
And the reason is I'm also an optimist about cities. And in the United States, we could do incredible things with the political will. We could do amazing things in our cities with the political will and with the desire to allocate funding towards those ideas. We could do incredible work with our schools. We could do incredible work with our transportation systems. We could do incredible work with affordable housing. So it's not easy, certainly, and people will disagree and sometimes for good reasons. But I would say politics, because there's a lot with political will we could begin to do for people in cities.
But somehow we don't have the political will to reduce the train times to New Haven.
Right. That's right. We have the technology to do it completely,
true.
Right?
Yes.
You're right.
In fact, it's going in the opposite direction. It takes longer and longer to get to New Haven over time.
Yes, it does. Compare, all right, Professor Sito, let's take India and China, because they're such different political systems. What have you observed there in terms of the attitude they have about urbanization, and two, how they plan or think they can deal with it?
Yeah, well, they could not be two more different countries when it comes to cities. When I started working in China about 20 years ago, China was just starting its urbanization revolution. And at that point in time, a lot of the policymakers still thought that keeping people in the countryside was the way to go. And it wasn't until major economic changes and they could see that cities were engines of growth. Now they've really been building cities top down and bottom up, and they have the political will to do so. And that's where this induced demand comes in as well, because now in China, I mean, my favorite thing to do during fieldwork was I'd always go to see the biggest house, because I thought, oh, how American is this? And they used to look like straight out of Southern California, Orange County, but now these houses are like 10,000 square feet. They're really spectacular, let's say. But in India, urbanization's at a very, very different scale. Urbanization in India looks much more like thousands of villages that are growing out, but not really up. The tallest building in all of India is about 23 or 25 stories. Compare that to Shanghai. India is just at a very, very different scale, and there's not as much infrastructure growth in India. So you've got a lot of people moving in, but you don't have the lights, you don't have water, you don't have sanitation.
So I've recently started a migration project in China, so from that perspective, I can tell you how what I learned that's different there compared to my interactions with policymakers in India or Bangladesh or Indonesia. So I was talking about these migration subsidies earlier, and I was very proud of myself that this year we scaled up those transportation subsidies to about 150,000 households, until I learned that the Chinese government is planning to move 10 million people over the next 5 years. So they have a program where, you know, they build cities, and they might look like ghost cities for a while, and then this is not something you can do in the United States or in democracies like India or Bangladesh. Chinese, you know, they can say, you, go move over there. And then they've now populated. I mean, so of course that comes with you know, there's opportunities there in that, you know, if you want to create productive places, you know, you can build cities, make people move together, and productivity goes up. But on the other hand, it also can undermine social connections, mm-hmm. right? So, for example, the different methods that they're using to move people. So one is, you know, taking entire villages and putting them in a block, right? Mm-hmm. And so
even everybody knows each other, has family
exactly.
ties.
And the other one that translates into the flower method is to take some villages and then scatter them. And so there's going to be, you know, trade-offs there, maybe economic versus social consequences. But I think the main difference that I see in the way that planning is done, in China, it is all planned and it's executed, right? But India, Bangladesh also has 5-year plans. Mm-hmm. They're just never well executed.
Yeah. You know, this is very interesting to see India and China begin to confront some of these issues. You know, in the United States, we also had our moment of very strong state-sponsored planning that damaged many of the social connections of existing neighborhoods. It's the urban renewal moment of the 50s and 60s, where in the public interest, places that many of us might have thought were neighborhoods, or sociologists like Herbert Gans began to look at the West End of Boston and see it as a neighborhood with sustaining connections. The planners, looking from above, could only see a mess and cleared them. It was incredibly damaging to social connections. And social psychologists began to study this, like Mark Fried, who wrote about grieving for a lost home. And so the question of social connections is very important. That's something that I'm studying with my students quite a lot in New Haven, is how people form memories around places, the importance mm-hmm. of those memories. Memories sometimes conflicting, and the same street streets are not singular, they're plural. The street means many different things to different people, although there are elements that are shared. And how preservation plays a role in this, how having certain buildings as landmarks and being able to reuse them. And that's very hard to quantify, the importance mm-hmm. of having landmarks or sense of place. It's very difficult to quantify that, but we believe it's very important and that it
you mean
has
for sort of social health, psychological
absolutely,
health.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's right.
Is that a value recognized in the developing world, the fast developing world that you two have seen?
I would say generally it hasn't, and I think this is a really huge challenge. And I'm so glad Elihu brought up the challenge of planning, because I think many people assume that, well, if we just got the planning right, everything would be okay.
Right.
But there are many other elements of this, certainly on the social side. I think that's really critical. Yeah. Many years ago, I can't remember how many years ago now, Elihu and I co-taught a class where we took Yale students to China and India. Mm-hmm. So they got to see these instant cities, cut-and-paste cities in China mm-hmm. that were, I mean, quite, they were economic marvels, really, because they sprang up overnight or over a very short period. I showed them the satellite images, and I said, look, this wasn't here last week. Right? And then we'd go to India where nothing worked, really. The roads didn't go. I'd show the same satellite image, like, oh, this road is still not built. But the students, remember, they said, oh, these cities have such a soul.
Right.
The Indian
right.
ones.
Yes.
So I'll share an anecdote about the neighborhood I grew up in Dhaka in Bangladesh. So actually the neighborhood next door to us used to be one of the nicer neighborhoods, had 1-2-story houses mm-hmm. on every plot of land. So it housed 2 families at most. And land values have gone up. Bangladesh has grown a lot, and most of that growth has been in Dhaka. And so now every single one of those houses has been torn down mm-hmm. and replaced with, 7-8-story high buildings. So now, with apartments, so now it houses 40 families rather than 2. So population in the neighborhood has gone up about 20 times. And of course, people are now richer, so they're much more likely to be car owners. When I was growing up, almost nobody had a car. We didn't have one. So now car ownership has probably gone up 40, 50 times compared to what it was. And the roads are no wider than they used to be. And in fact, because of parking, they've effective road width has decreased, right? And you know, in these neighborhoods, people's kids need to go to schools. They need hospitals and clinics as well. Those have also sprung up. And so that's just an extreme example of total lack of planning.
So to what degree can technology, because it's either planning or execution, but to what degree does technology provide an answer to, I don't want to call it a problem, a calamity, or an opportunity, but a way forward? In other words, can we, just as the Green Revolution made it possible for the human race to feed itself, essentially, even though many people still are not well fed, is there some other leap forward that's based in technology?
That's a good question, Margaret. You know, I think that there has been recently a kind of fetish for the smart city, and that if we could only rationalize our systems and get all the lights to turn at the right time and get the water to go to be available when we need it, and that, and there's a lot that can be accomplished with some of these smart systems, but it is in my own view, it is a bit of a red herring, because it's another kind of, it's another faith in expertise, and this time the expertise, the experts are robots. You know, it's too simple in some ways. It's another way of kind of removing human agency from the way the city is put together. But I think that, I think there is a lot of potential. I'd love to hear what Karen and Mishvik think about this in creating efficiencies where they're finding efficiencies where they're not right now. But I guess I'm just a little distrustful of it as a kind of answer. There may be things that come out of it, but it's a little too simple, perhaps.
I completely agree. I mean, the interesting thing is the most vibrant cities are not the most efficient ones.
Right, that's a great
point.
So
I'm from Hong Kong, and when we immigrated to the U.S., I'm not going to say when, but when we immigrated to the U.S., and I remember going back to Hong Kong was this mishmash kind of, it just had a lot of life and vitality because things weren't super hyper efficient.
Yes.
And now when we go back to Hong Kong, we say it's like Singapore. Things are too efficient.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, this is something that the great urbanist Jane Jacobs also wrote about. There's a kind of productive congestion there. And planners for a long time have sought to remove congestion, pure circulation. Yeah. But of course, where there's no congestion means desire and busyness and activity. And there are the kind of unplanned aspects of the city that come from that kind of productive congestion.
Now, that said, there's definitely room to be a more efficient. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's a lot of spaces around a city that aren't used, let's say, during different times of the day, during different days of the week.
Right.
And certainly density allows for the sharing economy in a way that wouldn't be enabled. But
yes.
But I think that's just an improvement. It's not going to be the solution.
Right. Even for sharing, like parking spaces
yes.
is what I'm
yes.
thinking
yes.
about now, too. Parking spaces used during the day and not during the night. If we can put into place a kind of system, and there's been a lot of advancements, as I think you all know now, with technology and mobility, there may be wonderful new efficiencies there. I think that's a good point.
I'll use borrow a phrase that Karen already used, induced demand.
Mm-hmm.
Mother is the necessity of invention. And so when there is necessity, technology, research and development follows, and we get new innovations. However, as probably clear from some of the anecdotes that we've been sharing, that technology by itself is not sufficient. There has to be policy influence. There has to, policymakers mm-hmm. have to be thinking about things correctly, provide the right set of incentives.
But do you think that the growth we saw on those maps will be mostly planned or mostly organic, for better or worse?
So a lot of those lights were in India, and a lot of them are in China.
Yeah, and Nigeria. I was surprised to read that that's going to be the other big yeah. kind of population explosion
urban hub. And on Java, those are the... So those countries, if we were to project forward, like those lights do, project forward what policy looks like, I think the answer to your question will be very different in China versus other parts of Asia.
I see. And what about in Africa?
Well, Africa's urbanization is totally different than that in China and India as well. In Africa, it's a much more informal economy across all the countries. And so what you see is that you're going to have a lot more urbanization that's not captured by the lights, because the informality is a much larger portion of urbanization.
Why wouldn't you see more lights?
Because these are informal settlements that don't have electricity or very little electricity. They're maybe tapped in. You know, one community with tens of thousands of people might have a little, you know, a few street lights, but it's not like planned housing or planned infrastructure in the U.S.
Do you have a thought on this?
In terms of the planned and the unplanned in terms of development, I mean, I'll tell you what it makes me think of in some sense is so many of us admire the urbanism of New York. Now, there's a planning gesture there that in 1807 and then in 1811, they laid out the great grid. And there's a wonderful intention there. Now, within that grid, there's been a tremendous amount of private individuals making their own decisions, and the way that 25-foot lots were divided, it's produced one of the most fascinating and satisfying urbanisms in the world. And I guess there needs to be a kind of balance there. It's when, maybe even working on the same grid, that urban planners begin to collect the small lots and to do a big project on a big lot. We look at the super block project and think that it's much more dead than being able to perceive the work of many hands. That can be very satisfying to see that. And I think that perhaps there needs to be some balance. There's a role for planning and setting up armatures for development, and then there need to be opportunities for individual agency within those armatures. And we've been lucky in many American cities to have those places. I mean, I'm very curious to hear what you think about Washington, D.C. urbanism, which, as you know, is a great planned, Baroque, French-style city. And yet within it, there are many things that are highly planned, and aren't there still interesting places as well? Every city will have its own texture. No, not. It's not, and perhaps not. But I think that it is. There's wonderful housing types in Washington, D.C. that that you don't see in a lot of other places. But in any event, every city has its own texture of development in that sense. It's wonderful to learn about what's going on in India and in China and the informality of Africa as you see different models being rolled out.
So something that's implicit in Elia's comments is that it's very difficult to retrospectively plan cities, right? Because there's hysteresis. If you've already built up the environment, it's extremely expensive. I guess technology can do anything.
And disruptive, as we discussed.
Absolutely. And therefore, the politics is going to be different as well, right? If it is disruptive and you're in a democracy, it's not like you can get rid of people. And this means that, you know, this type of a conversation that we're having, right, it's urgent for us to have that conversation in Lagos or in Abuja or in cities in India.
So trying to get ahead of the curve or it's already a tidal wave. But, well, we're just about to wrap up. I want to end on a sort of optimistic note. So I've asked my panelists to each come up with one innovation that they've heard about that's in their field. I know we don't think the technology is a panacea, but that you think has the potential to be transformative in some way. Who wants to start? Okay.
I can go. So I'll actually mention an innovation by two Yale alums, and I hope to inspire more people and more young students or young alums who are here to pursue innovations like this. So this is David Auerbach and Lindsay Siegel, who were Yale graduates. And then they got their MBAs at MIT. Time for boo. and then instead of pursuing the standard career of going into consulting, investment banking, etc., they moved to Nairobi and started a company called Sanergy.
Sanergy?
Yes. So they work in two slums in Nairobi, trying to provide sort of sustainable. They started a sanitation company, and it's kind of like a McDonald's. They have biz entrepreneurs who like buy their business in a box, set up shop, and shop means providing a toilet service. And then they have the logistics system in place to go clean that out on a daily basis because there is no sewage system there. And then the energy part of it comes from the fact that it turns out the waste can be converted to energy. They haven't quite figured that part yet.
Fascinating.
Okay, so we did not plan this ahead
of time. No, we did not.
Because my example is also about waste.
Okay.
So
shows us a topic we should have discussed more.
I was on sabbatical in Taipei several years ago, and two problems that plague every city are waste management, and especially around food. What do you do with all the wasted food? And so the city of Taipei has developed something very, very innovative. And we didn't figure this out for a while, but several times a week, you would hear Americans, we associate that tune with the ice cream truck. But it comes at about 9:30. And the first couple times it came, my husband and I looked out the window and we thought, why are they selling ice cream right now? But what we saw were all of our neighbors going out into the street in their pajamas with their bags of trash. Because the trash truck comes, and you, as the resident, are supposed to go and divide up your trash. So my husband took his trash, and he doesn't read Chinese. And so he was putting them in the wrong bins. But our neighbors very quickly explained to him that this is all the waste that's going to go to the pigs. This is the paper. Everything got divided. And so right now, I think Taipei recycles something like 60% of their waste, and a lot of their food waste gets sent to pigs. And I felt like this was an amazing way to get to know your community and to reduce waste and to also really take responsibility for what you buy.
My example is not about waste. It's about mobility, and in some ways I think it's very kind of mundane sort of improvement that actually is happening in many places and that I'd like to advocate happen even more. And I'm very concerned about bus systems in American cities, because we're not going to have the streetcar come back and the light rail won't be really efficient to do. But we have these bus systems now, and making the bus systems function more and more like a streetcar, with bus rapid transit, with stations that are more meaningful in their neighborhoods and are placemaking gestures in their neighborhoods, I think is very important. And sometimes giving designated lanes to the buses, or what I'd like to see in some cases is give the whole street to the bus and just let it be the busway and have the cars go elsewhere. Just the way I'd also like to give the whole street to the bikes, identify a few trunk lines and give it up, paint the whole thing green. And then once you're off the trunk line, you got to fend for yourself. But the small example, which again is happening, is one big thing about stress in cities is riding the bus in cities is stressful, and access to transit is uneven. It is often the poorest and least, those with least resources that ride the bus. And even knowing, and this is again, you've seen this in some places, even knowing when the bus is going to come is so important to people. And there have been incredible studies out there suggesting that your stress levels go down just knowing accurately, even if it's 12 minutes away. And so that's something where some smartness can really help. And I just think everyone should really have the right. We really need to improve our bus systems in American cities and kind of double down on the buses.
So I think we should end now with the hope that these and 1,000 other flowers bloom. And I want to thank our panelists. Please join me in thanking them. Brilliant professors. Bringing Yale. A great job. Thank you. And now it's my pleasure to introduce a man who doesn't need any introduction, but I've worked with since almost 10 years, my years on the corporation, as he was dean of Yale, he's provost of Yale. He's one of the inventors of the entire concept of artificial intelligence, and he also plays a mean bluegrass banjo. The 23rd president of Yale, Peter Salovey.
Thank you, Margaret. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thank you, Margaret. Thank you all for being here tonight. This is the first Yale Explorers event. And why not have it in Washington, D.C., right? We're so pleased to kick off this series, and we go to Boston next, and we're very interested in your feedback. What a pleasure to watch Margaret Warner at work. You know, if only every television newscaster were Margaret Warner. I could tell you my life would be a lot better, but that's another story for another day. And our three wonderful faculty members and the lively conversation they just had really exemplifies Yale's approach to the study of cities across disciplinary boundaries. That's a big theme when I talk about a more unified Yale. What you saw tonight really illustrates Yale research, Yale innovation, and all of that being applied to solving a problem, the problem of urbanization, which, as you heard, is a global problem. Well, I thought I would end the conversation today, at least the formal part of it, with some of my own observations, and then I'll join you at a reception, at the reception, and I can hear more input from you. You know, it's not every Yale event that has two receptions, one before the program and one after, so this is a new innovation, too. So we started off with a map. Let's see if we can get that map up here. That's what the Earth looks like today, if it were 1:30 in the morning everywhere, and here's what it will look like in 2050. This is, to me, a striking image of how the world is going to change. You know, it's clear that the population of the world is growing. You heard the statistics. But that growth is largely going to be in cities. And although most of the growth will be in cities, and therefore most cities will grow, not every city is growing. There'll be cities that are decreasing in population, too. Cities like Detroit or St. Louis or Chicago are actually shrinking. Cities like Raleigh, Orlando, Seattle, and as Elihu mentioned, even New Haven are growing. In fact, New Haven is the only city in Connecticut that is growing in population at present. And there are lessons that we can learn from studying cities that are growing and comparing them to cities that are shrinking. And we have to understand these lessons if we're going to understand how to make sure that urbanization, the inevitable urbanization, is beneficial to humans and to our planet. So we need to confront questions that our three faculty members raised. What makes a city, a society, healthy? What are the barriers that prevent us from reaching a state of health? How do we remove those barriers? So as you heard, my field is social psychology, and we think about these questions too, and perhaps my field lends yet another voice to this debate. For example, my field worries about, is concerned about, what makes a city, how would you define healthy? What do we mean by healthy when we say what makes a city healthy? So you might define healthy in one way, and you might define healthy in another way. Experts who are in different disciplines, they have wide-ranging definitions of healthy city and therefore wide-ranging research on what makes a healthy city. Well, as a psychologist, I would think about, perhaps, what makes a city mentally healthy. And I would think about emotional well-being and psychological well-being in 2050 as populations move to cities. With 66% of the population in cities, what will make them psychologically healthy? Well, we know that in cities, there's a greater risk for anxiety disorders. There's a greater risk of mood disorders. There's greater numbers of people who have drug addiction. Psychosis is higher in cities than it is in rural areas. What's that correlation all about? Is it traffic noise that's creating mental health problems? Is it social isolation? Is it economic inequality? Is it poor urban planning? Is it all the challenges that were just discussed? What is it that leads to greater mental health challenge? Maybe the causation is reversed. Maybe people with various kinds of psychological challenges are attracted to cities Because that's where you can get some help, right? That's where it's actually easier in some ways to get assistance. Well, that kind of causal question needs to be untangled. And it's going to be research and scholarship from the social sciences, yes, but also from the humanities and the sciences and arts that is going to help us untangle a question like that. Well, today you heard from faculty members from the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, from the School of Management, and from the School of Architecture. And what we're trying to illustrate here is that it takes the collective knowledge of experts across disciplinary boundaries, across the schools of Yale, to ask a complicated question like, what makes a city healthy and how can we have healthier cities? So today we found that a healthy city, a healthy society, enables all of its citizens to access food, access shelter, get educated, access medical care. Healthy cities and societies are resilient to disease, physical disease and psychological disease, right? But they're also resilient to changes in climate, changes in the environment more generally. These are healthy cities. In healthy cities, people live more productive lives, more meaningful lives. These healthy cities fuel innovation in the arts, in science, in medicine. These complexities, the complexities of managing growth in cities and so that they are healthy, is a 21st century problem that is not going to be addressed by just one discipline. It's not going to be addressed by a single school at Yale, a single department within the arts and sciences. Leaders in the arts, leaders in humanities, leaders in social sciences, leaders in science are all going to be needed to do the kinds of research and scholarship that is necessary to address that kind of complicated question. But we need something else. We need people who can translate the findings of academics into public policy. And this is where the research university, a research university like Yale, also can play an important role. So Yale can be vital, not just in creating the knowledge, but in translating it. Yes, we have our own experts, but we also can convene experts from elsewhere and convene political leaders who can have conversations across political boundaries. We have economists, architects, engineers, psychologists, historians, who all can create, curate, and communicate knowledge. But who do they do that to? To policymakers and other members of communities who then can adopt best practices. Let me give you a couple of examples. One is the Yale program on climate change communication. This is a group that surveys public attitudes toward climate change information. And their findings are then used to help legislators, policymakers, educators, and the media provide more effective messages about climate change. Universities can also bridge different viewpoints to turn a polarized debate into a productive discourse. Let me give you an example of that. We invited to Yale former secretaries of state. Two of them were Jim Baker, who served in the Reagan administration, and John Kerry, who served in the Obama administration. And we asked them to discuss the climate change agenda. And what a conversation like that teaches the world, and of course teaches our students along with it, is that you can bring people together from different political backgrounds, from different political parties, and you can get them to engage and find solutions to global challenges even and despite these pre-existing ideological differences. Even when two leaders, like Baker and Kerry, disagree with each other on other topics, you can ask them to try to find common ground and conquer a shared challenge, and they rise to that occasion. Well, universities can do another thing. They can also teach people to analyze and compare information against their pre-existing beliefs, right? To be critical thinkers, to challenge their long-held beliefs with new information, right? We teach our students, we teach future leaders to champion data-driven decision-making over, I would call it, ideologically based decision-making. And we think this is going to be important because it will allow leaders to adopt solutions that bridge the conflict that often exists between local issues and global interests. Those are the kind of leaders that we hope we're educating at Yale. Okay, most of us are going to live in cities in the years to come. Most of us probably live in cities now, and even more of us in the years to come. There's no stopping urbanization. And we have to help people understand that urbanization is not necessarily a bad thing. Cities are the engines of innovation, as you've heard. They bring advancements in medicine, in improvements in the quality of life, in the arts. But we have to manage this growth. And to that end, Yale is providing solutions. Yale, as you heard, is conducting cutting-edge research across disciplines that addresses the many components of urbanization, from the history of the Industrial Revolution to contemporary urban planning, from economics to sustainability. And through teaching by these faculty, our students are learning to be agile thinkers. They're learning to become leaders, leaders who can thrive in a quite rapidly changing world. So they will go on. They will make remarkable contributions to their professions, and I hope to their communities, especially if those communities are cities. And they will do that just as alumni from Yale have done that for generations, just as you as Yale alumni have done that in your lives. You do it every day. I hope you're here tonight because you celebrate and understand the importance of investing in knowledge. You know that investing in knowledge is investing in our future, your future, my future. And because so many of you feel that way, and therefore join us tonight, I have to thank you. I have to thank you for supporting the Yale community here in Washington. I have to thank you for supporting our first Yale Explorers event. And most of all, I have to thank you for all the support you give to Yale. But before we adjourn for our second reception, would you join me in thanking someone else, another group, Margaret and our three faculty members, Mushfik, Karen, Elihu, thank you so, so much. And now, let's enjoy each other's company. I will enjoy your comments and have another reception. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, during the reception, please be sure to visit the Yale Explorers video booth and to share your story. Thank you.